Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We all learn that addiction is a disease, a matter of genes and neurons and body chemistry. For addicts and their families, it certainly looks and feels like a plague. My guest today, research psychologist Gene Heyman, says it's not a disease. In a provocative new book, he argues that addiction is a choice or a bunch of bad choices. This hour, On Point, we'll hear his argument and a critique of his view. You can join the conversation. Have you been addicted to drugs, to alcohol? Did it feel like a choice, like a disease? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll hear perspectives from the Hazelden Addiction Clinic and the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Joining me first in the studio is Gene Heyman. He's a research psychologist at the renowned McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts, and a lecturer at the Harvard Medical School. His new book is Addiction, A Disorder of Choice. Gene Heyman, welcome to the show. Heyman, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to share what I have discovered in my research with you and your audience.
It's great to have you. It's a fascinating book, and it's also been kind of a stick on a wasp's nest. I've seen all kinds of furious response to what you've put out there, in part because, and I mentioned this earlier, but I mean, we all kind of come of age being told that addiction's a disease. Addiction's a disease. Begin to explain to us why you say no.
Right. First of all, let me just put one thing aside. Mm-hmm. That is that I'm not contrasting biology to experience. Choices have a biology. So let me just put that to the side. But let me tell you why.
That's a lot. We'll have to come back to that.
Yes,
but okay.
we can come back to that. But let me tell you how I come to my conclusions. The book is about the nature of addiction and the nature of voluntary behavior. And mm-hmm. I approach the two fundamental claims about addiction. One is that it's a chronic condition, and the other is that it is a disease. So how do we test if it's chronic? Well, I looked at the epidemiological data that has been conducted since the introduction of reliable psychiatric terms. And what every study shows that has been conducted in the last 40 years, mm-hmm. these national surveys, is that most addicts are actually ex-addicts, that they are no longer using drugs at clinically significant levels.
What does that tell you?
And that tells us that, first of all, by definition, it's not chronic, because when you look at the age data, what you see is that most have stopped in their early 30s. Now, these data are buried in tables by these epidemiological studies. And one of the reasons why we think people say it's a chronic disease is that they're looking at clinical samples, and something we can perhaps get back to.
You mean people who have come into clinics
exactly.
for treatment.
And it turns out that most people who meet the criteria for addiction do not go to clinics. That only, the most recent survey, only about 15%. And they're not only a numerical minority, they're also different in the sense that they're much more likely to suffer from other disorders.
Depression,
heart problems, stomach problems, AIDS, hepatitis, and all of these factors do not interfere with drug use, but they do interfere with the kinds of activities that compete with drug use.
What we would think of as healthier activities.
Yeah, exactly. And so what the research world has been looking at largely are these biased samples of individuals who are really not representative of the natural history of addiction.
But you say when you look globally at the full numbers that most addicts are ex-addicts.
Exactly.
If that's true, then what? What does that prove or say?
Well, there's two things we can ask, and this can get to the second question about the disease. We can ask what? First of all, when did they stop? So that takes care of the chronic issue. we can ask the question, what led them to stop using drugs, particularly if most of them stopped using drugs without going to a clinic? And so this, I have to just step back in a minute and say, what do we mean by disease? What do we mean by voluntary? What people mean by when they say addiction is a disease is that drug use has started out as voluntary consumption. Everybody goes for a drink. But then, because of changes in the brain due to the drug, it has become involuntary. So what does that mean? What does voluntary mean? And I think I use an everyday usage, which can be captured by an example. I once belonged to a gym, YMCA gym, and it had on the wall a sign that said, don't spit on the floor, it spreads diseases.
Okay.
They didn't have a sign that said, don't sneeze. Sneezing also spreads diseases.
So
what are they getting at? Well, spitting is something that can be influenced by its consequences. Sneezing, such things such as signs, the opinion of other people, costs and benefits.
Sneezing you really can't
You can't help. Well, what do we mean by can't help? We can't influence it by our consequences. So the question that I asked is, what influences drug use in addicts? What, for example, led them to quit? And I looked at a lot of different kinds of data sources. And what I found was that what influenced drug addicts to quit were the sorts of factors that influence everyday decisions, concerns about income, concerns about job, concerns about family. Can I be a better parent? Or even respect that they would hope to regain from their own parents. But values, costs and benefits, these are the factors that influence drug use.
I was fascinated by the example of GI heroin addicts in Vietnam as kind of illustrative of your point here as you present it. Can you tell us that story?
Yes. Well, that's an interesting case, and it's a well-known case. There's two things interesting. One is often overlooked. First is that when the GIs went to Vietnam, experimentation with opiates increased from about 5% to about 50%, and about half of those guys, to be exact, 23%, half of those guys ended up meeting the criteria of the researchers for addiction.
Reading here, 45% of those who turned to heroin became addicted to it. Is that? Have I got the right numbers?
Exactly. That's exactly the right.
45.
Heroin. Heroin is very different than alcohol. We don't see that with alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
But then when they came back to the United States, they were followed very closely by Lee Robbins of Washington University in St. Louis, and she discovered in these in-depth interviews and also doing urine samples that only 12% of them over a three-year period returned to opiate use on a regular basis, and then typically only briefly.
So in Vietnam, hellish situation, Vietnam War, GIs, a lot of people try heroin, 45% become addicted. Back in the States, only 12% stay addicted.
Of those, yes.
And that tells us what again?
Yeah. Excuse me?
That tells us what again?
Okay. So that tells us that addiction is a very situational disorder, and it's influenced by its local conditions. And this distinguishes it from other psychiatric disorders. We do not see those tremendous fluctuation in rates for schizophrenia, for depression, for OCD, for Tourette syndrome. Those disorders do not show that kind of situational property. And there's one other thing to get back to the clinical issue that and the bias samples. There were about a small percent, 6% of the GIs went to VA clinics for treatment. Guess what their relapse rates were? 70%. So the guys who went for treatment look just like the guys who go for treatment in the United States. And if Lee Robbins had done her study the traditional way, that is simply looking at clinic populations, she would have ended up with the same conclusion as everybody else does.
You know, but I can hear a lot of people listening to this, particularly when you raise that, and saying, my gosh, this sounds like some kind of return to a primitive disparagement of addicts. What are you saying? Don't go to treatment? Or it's a moral failing to be an addict. It's a choice at every moment of every day. Just stop it, will you? I mean, all these decades of the disease frame have pushed so hard against that, and with a lot of humanity in that push at many times.
Unfortunately, I don't, by choice, I don't mean free will. I mean that I mean activities that are influenced by a people's, individual's past, by their expectations, by the alternatives. And it turns out, as everybody knows who's tried to diet, who's tried to exercise more, is that making choices is very, very difficult, especially an addiction is typically difficult, is very difficult to stop. I don't mean to say that it is easy to quit. I think it's very, very difficult to quit. And that, in fact, those people who have quit deserve a lot more credit than they get.
But if it's not a disease, if it's not a chronic condition, what does that mean then in terms of how we look at addicts and their path out?
Okay. We look at them as I look at them as individuals who have had a hard time making the right choice, and they need help in making better choices. And this is something that I think doesn't And so the question we should ask is, how can we best help people make better choices about drugs when drugs are so attractive and maybe other things in their life currently are not so attractive?
The Toronto Star just teed off on your book.
Uh-huh.
And they said the lead of their story on your book is, go ahead, judge drug addicts, call them selfish. A Harvard psychologist gives you permission. And then they quote a whole series of people. Tony George at the University of Toronto says your argument crashes and burns. He's shocked that it's published. Here's Norman Miller at Michigan State. You know, these guys, you, don't care about the truth or what the studies show. Here's Norman Hoffman, Western Carolina University. What aspect of disease does he not understand?
Okay. So the question is, what do we mean by disease? And that's one of the last point. And there are two components to that. One is why people call addiction a disease. One is that it has a biological basis, which it does. And the other is the issue of this involuntariness. Now, the question of voluntariness we can look at by looking at the sorts of data that we see from clinics, that we see in clinical diaries, and that we see in ethnographies like the Vietnam study.
Gene Heyman, hold the thought if you'd be good enough. We have to take a short break right here. Gene Heyman's new book is Addiction, A Disorder of Choice. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about addiction and a provocative new claim that it is not a disease, but a choice. Research psychologist Gene Heyman is with me, a psychologist at McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts, a lecturer at Harvard Medical School. His new book is Addiction, A Disorder of Choice. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. We're going to hear some professional pushback and go further into what Gene Heyman is laying out here. But I want to hear from our listeners. There's a lot of experience out there in the world. Christy in Concord, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Gene Heyman.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you so much for taking my call. This is something that has been very deep-rooted in my life. I come from a family of addicts on both sides. Both of my parents were very strong heroin addicts, and they both come from families of addicts.
Okay.
I actually am the one that broke the cycle on two families, which is absolutely incredible. And it's
congratulations.
Just by the choices that I've made. Thank you so much. I just want to say that I'm really deeply fascinated with the genealogy versus the choices. And I do believe, I mean, I grew up in an environment with, you know, not being able to eat a meal and having to watch, you know, my parents cook up heroin on a spoon. And I didn't make those choices. And I have a lot of friends that came from good homes who made bad choices, who went and did heroin. So to me, I just want to say the environment and genealogy, it's just absolutely fascinating. And that people have their own will and choices to make of how they want to live their lives. And a lot of people are affected by the environment that they're brought up in, and then a lot of people go the complete opposite way in which I did. And I'm raising my children talking a lot about drugs and the environment and how we can make our own positive choices. And I just
Christy, let me ask you, you say you've escaped two generations of this on both sides, by choice.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, if you've been in that world where, you know, there's no dinner and heroin's being cooked on a spoon, you know how widespread the view is that this is disease, and not just in lay terms, but professional terms. I mean, with your own parents, do you really think they had the choice just to drop that spoon and have some cornflakes instead and all done?
Well, I do. I mean, they came from a family of addicts, and I believe that they could have made different choices. My father chose to do heroin for 25 years. He's now 55. He's been sober for 10. And he actually goes to jails and to homeless shelters and helps other people that are trying to get sober. His whole group of friends are now deceased, and he's the last one living. My mom has been sober for 5 years, and she's doing quite well. But I just want to say that you really do have a choice. You know, you can make any choice that you want to in the world. And, I mean, it's embedded in my genes, not just from both my mother and my father, but their families. I am literally the only one to break the cycle after many generations of addictions. And I just think it's a wonderful thing, but it is a choice. And if you have willpower and if you can educate yourself and decide to be healthy, then, you know, that is what it is. And
Christy, your story is compelling. I want to get Gene Heumann's response here. What do you hear in this, Gene? I mean, you know how many people have not been able to do this, right, and how often they've been told, well, there's a reason.
Two things. First of all, hi, Christy, and thanks for your call. I think that's an interesting story, and I'd like to make the emphasize that, yes, it's easy to believe that many people have a genetic predisposition for drug use, for risk-taking, and so on, just as they have a genetic predisposition for mathematics or music. But it doesn't mean that you have to be a mathematician or have to be a musician or have to be a drug addict. And the reason for that is that we inherit DNA. We do not inherit traits. And the DNA interacts with our behavior and with the environment to yield traits. And those traits involve are often traits that can be influenced by their consequences.
So but you said at the outset, yeah, choice has a biology.
Exactly.
Which makes it sound so written in your genes. Yeah,
and so there is a biological predisposition for making certain choices. An interesting study that is discussed in the book is think of religion. We think of religion beliefs as voluntary. People give up, they adopt religion. But it turns out that if you look at separated twins, that fraternal twins who share half their genes, are much, much less likely to share religious belief than identical twins, even though they did not grow up together. And so there are biases that influence dispositions, that influence attitudes, that then affect things like religion.
So you're not denying a disposition toward
precisely,
addiction.
Precisely, precisely. So I think what captures my view best, or one of the things, mm-hmm, that I know best, is this expression that emerged in addiction, but not in other disorders, of hitting bottom. And what hitting bottom captures, mm-hmm, is first the idea that that using drugs can lead to terrible, terrible conditions. And when the person hits bottom, what they're saying is that they're looking at the abyss, that around the corner is either ruin or perhaps death. But then they quit. Hitting bottom is a punctuation mark. It marks a change in their trajectory. And what it tells us is that, yes, drugs are very, very terrible. It's very, very hard to quit. Your life almost has to be on the line. But using the drugs do not prevent quitting.
Let me go to Melissa in, yeah, Voluntown, Connecticut, for another perspective here. Melissa, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm an recovering alcoholic and addict, and as much as I enjoy hearing your perspective, I really have to disagree. It runs in my family, just like the previous caller had said, but it is chronic. I have kids, I had a family, I had a job. None of that, I lost it all, and none of it, and alcohol and drugs didn't make me, like, think back and say, oh, I really want to not lose any more jobs. I really want to keep my kids. The thing that got me is that I almost died. And it's chronic. It's like if you think about it, when you go to a party and you smoke a cigarette or you drink a beer, and then the next day you don't, there is no off switch for me.
But you've stopped now, at least for now, you've said, Melissa.
Yeah, because I went to rehab, because I treat it like a disease. I work a recovery program every day for the rest of my life. It's just like taking medicine for diabetes or going to get chemo for cancer. It's something I have to work on every day. If I don't
yep,
keep up with my recovery program,
yep,
if I don't go to my meetings, I'll get high again.
Melissa, stand by. Gene Heumann, she says her recovery program is her chemo,
right,
and is treating a disease, which you say it's not.
Well, what I would like Melissa to think about and the audience to think about is to think about choices as being influenced by their consequences, not free will, being determined. And so if it's hard to make a choice once, it may be very hard to keep making that choice. Just think about people who are on a diet. They put it's very hard for them to stick to the diet. making choices is not easy, and the reason it's not easy is because they have their determinants. And so I'm not saying that a choice is easy, and I'm saying that choices have causes just like diseases have causes. But I'm saying what the distinction is that Melissa is able to quit because of the kinds of things, let's say do in AA, which is provide environments that don't have drugs, that don't have alcohol, social. They provide opportunities for people to establish good social relations. And these kinds of treatments, these kinds of effects do not work for schizophrenia, do not work for OCD. There aren't AA type of organization. So yes, some people have to work at it very hard every day. For many people, it gets easier to not use drugs, but for some people, they still have to work at it. But this doesn't mean it's not a choice.
She sees it as a disease. I some points here, I wonder if it's semantic here, but professionally, many people would say otherwise. I want to get, Melissa, thank you for your call. I want to get a professional view here. Joining us right now from Center City, Minnesota, is Marvin Seppala. He's Chief Medical Officer for the Hazelden Foundation. It's a nonprofit alcohol and drug addiction treatment center, a very famous one at that. Marvin Seppala, thank you very much for being here.
Glad to be. Hi, Tom.
What do you think of the notion Gene Hayman's put out there and argued at some length in his book that addiction is not a disease?
Well, first of all, the brain is dramatically altered by addiction and influenced by genetics. And this notion that there's choice involved is certainly an old traditional way of understanding addiction. And this has been put forward in many other books as well, and we understand it remarkably differently now. If you look at initial use of substances, as my teenage daughter did when she told me addiction's not a disease because she'd seen her friends start to use, just as the prior caller, the first caller who said that her parents were addicted and she's not, you know, there is choice in initial use. There's even choice up to moderate use and even early addictive use. However, once people cross a line into addiction, choice is no longer necessarily available to them. However, it's really easy to look at choice when people do start to make decisions to end addiction and suggest that somehow choice made all the difference, and that's not necessarily true.
But how can, I mean, I trust you're in the middle of this and working it all the time. Gene Hayman has done the same and done a lot of research. You both seem serious and earnest here. How can two serious, earnest people come to such an opposite conclusion about this? Does that mean, Marvin Seppala, there's something semantic in this conversation, or is it a fundamentally different understanding of addiction?
I do think there's both. I mean, one example I can give you, I wasn't convinced this was a disease early in my career, certainly not during medical school and then into residency. I met a psychiatrist who did research on rats, and he could order a strain of rats who would not use alcohol. They just avoided it, wouldn't touch it. He could order a strain of rats who would use alcohol, they'd drink water, they didn't care. They didn't become alcoholic either. And then he could order a strain of rats for his research that would drink themselves to death. And I've never seen many choices made by rats in this regard. It's a biologically influenced behavior.
When you talk to heroin addicts, I mean, you know, the suggestion here is that they're heroin addicts, but they have a choice. The right circumstances, the right, I don't know, willpower or something, they could choose their way out of it.
Well, I think they have to start making good choices, but the truth is that in the middle of heroin addiction, you know, one of the things about choice is we think of it kind of like a prior theory of addiction is that it's a hedonic act, that we like it so much we can't stop. And if you talk to heroin addicts, they'll tell you, you know, the last time I enjoyed this, I can't even remember. You know, it goes way back.
They're just trying to avoid withdrawal symptoms.
Yeah, they're trying to avoid pain. That's part of it. And if they could make a choice, wouldn't you think they'd stop before they'd lost their jobs, their wives, their families, and everything else? I can give you an example of an anesthesiologist, highly trained, bright individual, was found in the operating room early in the morning by a janitor, watching him dump out the sharps box, the container, you know, of all the biohazardous material. It had all these needles and broken vials in it, and he was sifting through the stuff barehanded. A remarkably bright individual, barehanded, looking for a little vial that might have a few drops left of fentanyl, a remarkably powerful opioid, 100 times more powerful than heroin. And so, you can't argue that somehow he was making a choice in that moment to risk his life to continue the use of that substance.
Marvin Sepple, let's stand by. Gene Heyman, here's Marvin Sepple, the Hazelden Foundation. What do you make of the gap between his understanding and your own of addiction?
I think the gap has two sources. One is, and I think to say something, it has to do with the understanding of what we mean by choice, and the other is the literature itself, familiarity with what literature we're looking at. The understanding of choice that I have is one which has been part of, I think, human culture since the beginning. We have distinguished between medicine men, and we've distinguished between wise men before civilization actually starts. And the distinction is that some activities are influenced by their consequences. Those are the kinds of things wise men take care of, and medicine men took care of things that couldn't be influenced by the local tribe, by
ethos, the weather,
and so on. So that's a very fundamental distinction. And if we don't make that distinction, we're in a situation where we could blame schizophrenics for having hallucinations because we don't distinguish between voluntary and involuntary, or we could give criminals pills and not jail. So I think it's a very fundamental difference that we need to make between activities that can be influenced by their consequences and those that cannot.
Make that more explicit when it comes to drug addiction.
Okay, when it comes to addiction, the issue is, does the guy who is sifting through the box of sharps, mm-hmm. could we imagine a situation or could a situation be arranged such that he would stop, that he said, I've hit bottom, and I'm going to stop doing that? And what are the kinds of conditions that do that? And the kinds of conditions, when you look at the literature, are people said, I'm being a terrible father. I have to take care of my father. I'm being a terrible husband. When you look at the clinical literature, this is what you see. And not only in the clinical, in these narratives, but we look at treatment programs that have proven effective. And the treatment programs that have proven very effective institutionalized the principle that I'm saying. They arrange consequences for drug use. And there are a number of very successful programs, and this is actually what AA does also.
Let me put that to Marvin Sepple. Yeah. Marvin, Gene Heyman writes, if I've got this right, that if you look at heavily addicted physicians or airline pilots, and they're subjected to testing and told their jobs are on the line, heavily addicted doctors, pilots, you find that they have recovery rates well above 80%. Now, that's true. What does that say about the disease frame here?
Well, there is truth to that. They have the highest recorded recovery rates. However, you know, we see physicians dying from this disease. You know, we find anesthesia residents in call rooms with needles in their arms. And so if it was just a matter of choice, I wouldn't think that we'd be seeing such things. And I'd hearken back to animal models. We have animal models of addiction, and you can't argue that these rats somehow are making choices when we influence their addiction by stress. We have animal models of relapse in that, you know, we get an animal addicted to a certain substance, whether they know they're using it or not. Usually, though, they'd have to pound on a bar 25 times to get an injection of whatever the substance is. And if you influence them in a way that they become addicted, and then you remove the addictive substance so they can't get it, they will continue to pound on the bar for a couple of days in a dramatic fashion in an attempt to get another hit of the substance, and then the behavior extinguishes itself. However, if you stress the animal, they go right back to the bar and start pounding on it, without knowledge of what's going on, without choice. If you remove them from their original cage and then put them back in a similar cage, perhaps with the same kind of cedar chips or something, a trigger or a cue to what it was like while they were using that substance, they go right back to the bar and start pounding away. Or if you provide a small amount of the substance without them pounding on the bar, without their knowledge, they'll go over to the bar and start pounding on it again, just as the alcoholic who has a single drink, thinking they can drink like normal folks, will suddenly find themselves blacked out and in all the trouble that they often get into once they restart the use of alcohol.
Marvin Sepple, Chief Medical Officer at the Hazelden Foundation in Center City, Minnesota. Mr. Sepple, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, too.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about addiction and a provocative new book that claims it is not a disease but a choice. Not the first, but very current, all tied up with behavioral economics in the view of Gene Ammon, my guest today, research psychologist at McLean Hospital, lecturer at Harvard Medical School. His book is Addiction, A Disorder of Choice. There's a good excerpt at our website, On Point Radio. We have a lot of callers and more guests, but Gene Ammon, I want to give you a chance to respond to Marvin Sepala in Minnesota, describing, never mind humans, just animals sort of desperately going for it.
Thank you. Let me just respond to two aspects of what he said. One is the idea that people could not possibly make foolish even choices that risk their own life. And I just refer the listeners to our literature tradition. Homer starts off in the Iliad with Agamemnon stealing Achilles' bride, something that was terribly counterproductive, yet he chooses to do it anyway. So
guaranteed to be big trouble.
Yeah.
But it was.
But he does it. He chooses anyway. So we don't necessarily make wise choices, and maybe I'll have a chance to explain why we really don't choose to be an addict, yet choice leads to addiction. The second thing that he brought up was the animal literature. And I just want to refer, the audience to some research and to add a perspective to the studies that Marvin Sepala was describing. In those studies, the animals have no alternative. They just have alcohol. I actually do this kind of research.
Mm-hmm.
But when you insert an alternative, let's say food or even saccharin, the animals typically switch to the food. And the most dramatic study like this was done by Serge Ahmed and his colleagues at University of Bordeaux. They had rats literally swimming in cocaine. No organism has taken as much cocaine as these rats.
Oh.
However, they were self-administering it. There was no alternative. They just took cocaine. When Serge added some saccharin to the chamber, all the rats switched.
Saccharin? Like
saccharin.
Artificial sweetener?
Yeah, without even nutrients, switched from the cocaine to the saccharin.
What does it mean?
It means that when they have an alternative, they happen to like saccharin better than cocaine. And even though their brains have been altered by the cocaine, their brains were not altered in a way that prevented them from responding to saccharin as they and to make a different kind of behavior.
But let's make it human. Yeah. Take a heroin addict, okay. You know, lying in the gutter with a needle in the arm, homeless.
Okay.
Offer them, you know, a nice house, a warm kitchen, a fridge full of good food. They may still be a heroin addict the next day.
Well, there are two things to say. One is the heroin addict has, in a sense, often created a situation like the experimenters create for the rats. That is, their drug use has eliminated all of the – has undermined the capacity to engage in competing activities. The experimenters do this, manipulate this. So then the question is, what does the heroin addict need to start making different kinds of choices? And that's the clinical question. And that can vary widely from individual to individual, and there are many different stories. But one of the stories, which is so interesting, and I think so, it captures addiction and distinguishes it from schizophrenia or OCD, is that a common story is that people start becoming very concerned about how their family members think of them and how they're treating their children. And it turns out that family relations is often a very big factor in turning a heroin addict around, turning a cocaine addict around. And these events don't occur with these other disorders. So
A supportive family can't take away your diabetes, you're saying?
Unfortunately, it can't.
But I've known supportive families,
okay.
At least I thought they were supportive, who couldn't cure their loved ones of addiction.
Human variation is immense.
Yes.
And I think the thing to look at is what's interesting and what's important and what's encouraging is to look at what happens typically. And typically we see that 75% of addicts at the age of 42 are ex-addicts.
Mm-hmm.
We look at the conditions that led them to quit. And that's where I think we should – that, I think, is where we should take practical advice. Theoretically, there may be people who can never change, but that doesn't mean that they – can't make a choice.
And you're looking at economic incentives,
essentially.
It
means that we don't know how to influence their choices.
But the positive path you're describing as a result of options for economic advancement or stable life or love.
Moral advancement.
Moral advancement.
It could be, in the sense of being a better parent.
Uh-huh.
What's very interesting, there's an interesting article by David Carr, a New York Times reporter, and he was a serious cocaine addict. And what turned him around was when he had twins. And he began thinking, he said, I was not raised to be a bad parent. Being a cocaine addict means being a bad parent. And that eventually led him to change.
But, of course, our very first caller was raised by two heroin addicts
who didn't
stop.
We don't know how everybody, everybody has their own story. And if human behavior were easily to understand, we could arrange circumstances so that everybody quit using drugs. But human behavior is very difficult to understand.
I want to get a couple of calls and another perspective here from Los Angeles, California. Saad, you're on the air.
Saad.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
My question is addiction a disease of modernity, or, if you don't want to call it a disease, a condition of civilization? Looking at history before, addictive substances have been available all along. Wine, tobacco, even opioids were used as medicinal substances. They have been readily available, yet you don't really see in the historical record that there was such an epidemic of addiction. I wonder if it is not just at the individual, the addict level. Society, civilization, peer pressure, society pressure is playing a role here as well.
Fascinating. Thank you, Saad. Gene Heyman.
Great question. The caller is absolutely right. Opiates have been available since the beginning of recorded history. When do we see our first opium epidemic? It turns out that it's in China at in the 18th century. So opium has been available forever in terms of human historical record, but what changed to lead to an opiate epidemic in China? Two things. One is pharmacological. People began smoking opium. And second, there appears to be a great deal there's some other environmental factors like leisure time available. There was a bureaucratic class that had time on their hands. And the reason I say that there had to be something else besides the pharmacology of smoking opium, which brings opium to the brain more quickly, is that in other cultures, people smoked opium. In India, where the opium was grown, people could smoke opium, but an opium epidemic did not occur initially there. It occurred in China. So there was something about Chinese society, and my hunch is, and there is not good historical research on this, that it was the availability of leisure time and surplus wealth that allowed addiction to take place there rather than in India.
To Saad's point, you seem to draw a line between our contemporary culture, our consumer culture, and addiction. Did I read you right on that? Is there some kind of philosophical connection you're making?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, I mean, I got the sense of you describing choice. People are making choices in a consumer culture. You reach out and you grab that gratification that's part of consumer culture. Drug addiction, as you describe it, seems to have a similar kind of tempo to it.
Right. I think that there is a similarity. The other part of the book is about the nature of voluntary behavior, and I see addiction as kind of the most extreme example of the foibles of voluntary behavior and of the self-destructive capacities of voluntary behavior. But we see similar trends, of course, in eating and, of course, in overconsumption of all types of goods. And I think that the way people make choices, and it's leads to overconsumption. And let me just give you one example related to drugs. I say that people don't choose to be an addict, but choices lead to addiction. And the kind of example that might make this sensible is that imagine you're a smoker and you haven't had a cigarette for an hour. The next 3 minutes with a cigarette is much better than the next 3 minutes without a cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
Because of withdrawal and other symptoms.
You feel comforted. Right.
However, if you were to choose, the same person were to choose between a lifetime of smoking and a lifetime of not smoking, they all point out that they would choose not to smoke.
Mm.
So they don't choose to be a smoker, but they choose to have one more cigarette or to quit tomorrow. And a series of one more cigarettes or a long series of I'm going to quit tomorrow end up in the pattern of behavior that we call addiction.
John in Canton, New York. You're on the air, John.
I believe that choices are involved, but it is a disease. I mean, I've been recovering for 8 years. If I was to pick up today, I would pick up right where I left off 8 years ago. You know, it wouldn't be a gradual thing like when I first started. I mean, I would just use...
Just slam, bam, you'd be right back at it. Is it helpful, what Gene Heyman is saying? Is it dangerous? How do you see it?
I believe it's danger for any future research, you know, a theory of thinking like this, you know, that it's not a disease. We just say, no, we're not going to use, and it's not a disease. And, you know, I believe it's a disease. It's hereditary, and I believe science has very little knowledge of why people are addicted.
John, we've got it. Thank you very much for your call. Let me get one more guest here. We've just got a few minutes, but Nora Falco joins us from Washington, D.C. She's director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the National Institutes of Health. She has been instrumental in building the case for drug addiction as a disease of the brain. Nora Falco, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for your patience. You hear Gene Heyman's argument. What do you think of it?
Hello. Thanks for having me here. I think it's important, actually, to look at different perspectives. I think that the issue in many instances can be called as semantics, because if you say choice, but what is it really that we mean by choice? Is it the conscious act of saying, I want to do this versus I don't want to do it? And there are biological systems, there are areas of our brain that are responsible for enabling us to carry those choices. And we now understand, actually, the circuitry, not completely, but we do know what there are many areas in the frontal cortex that need to function properly in order for us to be able to say, I don't want to do this, and be able to stop, to inhibit that desire to do it. So it's like the brakes. So I'm driving a car, mm-hmm. and I want to stop. I see someone running in front of me. But if my brakes are not working properly, mm-hmm. even though I choose to stop, I'm not going to be able to stop. And I think that's why, in a way, I call it somewhat like a semantic, because speaking of choice assuming that we are all able to carry the choices we make is theoretically would be wonderful, but that's not the way that our brain unfortunately works.
Norvaka, let me ask you, you're at the National Institutes of Health. Our national policy seems to indicate some kind of contradiction here, maybe. I mean, we throw people in prison for drug use. If it's for addiction, you might say, if it's a disease, I mean, we don't throw people in prison for having diabetes. Putting people in prison suggests that there is a moral choice of some kind here, doesn't it? Or do we have a contradiction in our policy?
Well, I'm not going to specifically comment in terms of the contradictions of not of the policy, because those policies are not just based on science, and they're based on multiple other factors.
True.
That plays a role. But one of the things why people have criticized the concept of drug addiction as a disease is that they say it removes the responsibility of the person that's addicted. Mm-hmm. But that's not the case. If you have a disease, you are responsible for changing your behavior in such a way that your disease can be properly managed. And that pertains to diabetes, that pertains to infectious disease, that pertains to a mental illness. In the case of drug addiction, the person has a responsibility to understand under what conditions they are at risk and how to avoid them. They have the responsibility
right.
to seek treatment.
You may not agree with Gene Heyman, but his book is very interesting. Do you think this kind of conversation is helpful when it comes to our national discussion about addiction, or detrimental?
My perspective is it is important to actually listen to different arguments so that we can understand where there may be difficulty of people to comprehend drug addiction. It's what appears to be a very irrational behavior, because it does not follow the normal rules of cognition, conscious control. It actually questions what we've always been valuing as one of the most important processes in human
moral agency,
free will, mm-hmm. the ability to exert free will, to decide that I don't want to do something and I will be able to stop it. So to accept that there are brain structures that actually are damaged by drugs that are directly responsible for us to be able to make choices. It's very difficult for people that have perfect control. Mm. So they say, yes, they choose. Why don't they just say no?
Mm. Nora Falco, you're terrific, and I wish we had more time today. I hope we can talk with you again at the National Institute of Drug Abuse, director there. Nora, thank you very much for joining
us. You're
very
welcome.
Gene Heyman, we've just got a couple of minutes here. You've heard our callers. You hear Nora. We'll let you sort of wrap up your view of what's going on and where your view would take us.
Okay. What I would like to people to go away with, one, is that they look at a lot of the data that are in the book that are about recovery, and we see that their rates are a lot higher. Two, that the data are actually very encouraging. They show that people can quit and typically do quit. And I think that it is probably not helpful to tell people that they have a chronic relapsing disease when, in fact, there are most of the people who have the diagnosis that they have do quit. And
but our caller John said one drink tomorrow and he'd be right back at it after 8 years.
So there may be different ways of maintaining sobriety. Mm-hmm. Some people it may be easier than harder, but I think that the data are actually very helpful, and I think that we should incorporate what the data tell us about the nature of quitting more directly into our treatment plans, and those treatments which have done that have proven very effective. And I don't mean to say that quitting is easy or that blaming people is the way to get them to quit. There are many, many different ways, and we need to be creative about it.
Gene Heyman's new book is Addiction, A Disorder of Choice, a fascinating book, fascinating conversation. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. I don't know who to agree with here, but you really make us think about this, and I'm grateful for that. Gene Heyman, research psychologist at McLean Hospital, lecturer at Harvard Medical School, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me and have a chance to share my findings with your audience.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.